This program is brought to you by the Kentucky Women Writers Conference on iTunes U at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. For more information on the conference and to access our complete audio archive, visit us online at KentuckyWomenWriters.org.
Thank you. Welcome to the library. Good afternoon. I hope that you've had a wonderful conference so far. As she said, my name is Tanya Head. I'm the manager of the Adult Services Department here at Central. And we're very pleased to have you here during your conference. It's a wonderful thing. So this last afternoon's session features readings by two really fantastic poets, Jennifer Chang and Simone Minch. Jennifer Chang's poems have been featured or are forthcoming in a number of journals, including Boston Review, The New Republic, and Virginia Quarterly Review. Her work has been anthologized in Asian American Poetry, The Next Generation, Best New Poets 2005, and this year's Best Fantasy and Horror 2006. She was the 2005 Van Leer Fellow in Poetry at the Asian American Writers Workshop and has received fellowships and scholarships from Bread Loaf Writers Conference, Swanee Writers Conference, the McDowell Colony, and Yaddo. She is a PhD student in English at the University of Virginia. This afternoon, she is reading selections from her debut collection, The History of Anonymity, from the University of Georgia Press. Simone Minch is the author of The Air Lost in Breathing, winner of the Marianne Moore Prize for Poetry, and Lamplack and Ash, winner of the Catherine A. Morton Prize for Poetry. She is a recipient of two Illinois Arts Council Fellowships, the 49th Parallel Poetry Award, the PSA's Fine Lines Contest, the Charles Goodnow Award, the AWP Intro Journals Award, the Poetry Center's 9th Annual Juried Reading Award, and the PSA's Bright Lights Big Verse Contest. She received her PhD from the University of Illinois at Chicago and now directs the writing program at Lewis University, where she teaches creative writing and film studies. Additionally, she serves on the advisory board for Switchback Books and Universe, a United Nations of Poetry, and is an editor for Shark Forum. She is a vegetarian and a horror film fan. This afternoon, she is reading from her most recent collection, Orange Crush, published this year by Saraband Books. So two very great poets. We hope you will come back to visit us often here at the library and use all of our resources. We have quite a few writers' resources on the third floor, as well as a lot of electronic resources that you could use anywhere you're writing. So again, welcome. And a quick just housekeeping reminder, if you've parked in our parking garage, please take one of the validated parking tickets with you before you leave. I hope that you enjoy the readings. Thank you.
How's that? Can you hear me? I've spent the last few weeks traveling from library to library on a research trip, and it's really wonderful to be amongst poets and writers and to be in a library like this, which is it's so much more cheerful than some of the archives I've been in. And it was great to be here this morning and meeting my students and just being in poetry, especially this weekend. And I feel like I woke up with a lot of things and a lot of losses. It is September 11th, and I thought I would begin by reading a poem from my book, The History of Anonymity. I'm afraid it's the only poem I'll be reading from the book today, but it's a prayer. Sea Psalm. We see no ships at harbor. The sea is a sky's gray mirror, and I am in the dream of its plain reflection, the still water before a wave's ascent. What rise left in me is left to follow you to shore, is an edge to narrow what shoulders you, I cut the beach to bring you to water, and the odd wonder you shoulder like a one-winged bird. I want to call you love, as I want to call the driftwood house. Daily, we age into erosion's remnants, carving our lines out of the coast, and I am learning to forgive my longing to make strangeness unstrange, that our shadows subsuming us do not complete us. Where in the shell-mottled sand will we make our ragged bed? Now, love, the sea wind salts our young skin, our bodies turn to shell. Let us be emptied as this off-season shore, to be loved for what we lack. So the poems I'll be reading today mostly, they all come from a book in progress that is currently titled Some Say the Lark. I guess I'll say more about it as I read along, but so these are new. And I think in the spirit of sharing new things this weekend, I thought I would try them out today, so please bear with me. This poem is in fragments, and the title comes from Emily Dickinson. Myself be noon to him. He left my plight wild and still as lyric. Moths in the sea plume, a freak of lightning, no storm. The tide's argument to evade the shore or crest. If in patience, if orbital motion, master it. So, the sea asked. I envy the one-word lexicon, the sea's singular mastery. So, to declare certitude. So, to not care. And so much to not care about. Description, namely, every word testing what's real, only to fail. Today I feel sad, but somehow this is wrong. Gulls disappear into the palest sky. I feel quiet. I am not quite myself today. Gray wings and gray clouds. Godwit birds outrun the tide. Today I am a fragment of shell thinking of him. So, yellow beach grass struck by surf. Meaning is the wing, but I did not mean so much as meander. The black hurt gnawing at, the black hurt he deemed shame. And where should I go now that I've reached the sea? I was thinking about a time before war, when the sea was not a border and we dove into the punishing waves. Some shore noises I forget, the hour shifting with a tide turn like an octave dropped, sand scatter against our bodies, phantom cries from phantom children. I want to write a poem with nothing in it. No more birds tracing the coast, no anxious clock, no lists of loss, no song other than midday amnesty, fragment of sun. I think this is not the same beach, too thin a shoreline, too close to town. So a few years ago, I was priced out of Brooklyn and had to move to Jersey City, which isn't as bad as it sounds. I'm actually from northern Jersey, so it was a familiar landscape. But while I was living there, there was an accident one winter. It was a really foggy winter, not a snowy one like this past one, but it was very foggy, and an ambulance truck accidentally drove off the bridge by the Hackensack. And for several days afterward, there were helicopters circling around the area where I lived, and suddenly the helicopter stopped and it was quiet and we realized the bodies had been found. But this really infiltrated my imagination, and it's sort of one, the idea of the lost body, this missing person who I didn't know and yet who was very much present every day of my life for a week. It's sort of a thematic thread in the current book in progress, a stranger, a sense of loss that's pervasive. So this is a longer poem, and it's inspired by the landscape and also the event, but it's in a different season, and because it's poetry, it doesn't have to be factual. And it's also in fragments. There are two characters in it. There's the speaker and her companion. They're in search of the lost body, and the companion's name is Sister Elizabeth. I'm already breathless. River pilgrims. I'm the one who's raw. I'm the one learning the river's silt and scum, how the sediment floats but the muck and mire sink. Sister Elizabeth, what do the asphalt confess? The yellow fumes, the pink fumes, the squat white tanks hoarding alien fuel, my exhausted portents. I'm the pom-pom girl of the current apocalypse, half gone, all gone, carcinogenic cloud. The loons, grease slick in the Hackensack, go red-eyed with loon cries. Sister Elizabeth, who will dry your dewy brow? Winter never started, and the chorus girls are jubilant pairs. Can you do the can-can, the sleight of hand, the slightly out-of-date grandstand? God's in the soccer field. He's in your messenger bag, deleting your stump speech. Like the rain, he's all. Never mind. I have two Bartlett pears and a Chinese umbrella. Let's go. I loved my heir senseless and was not sisterly. Do you forgive? I don't. Look what concrete makes. A beige cake, a mode-resistant gutter, and still the stranger drowned. If we follow his body, we'll discover how the river ends. I wager blue resolution, not the ocean, but the ocean's childless oracle, where the city barges congregate and dispose of the city's waste. The ducks have grown accustomed to the stream of gasoline that braids itself into each ripple. I watch their brave swimming make white foam, sinuous ribbons of water. How the river ends, only the ducks and detritus will know. Some fog caught his body's midnight mission to skip over the current like a palm flat stone. Now is when you explain that sorrow's aboriginal and platonic. Your order, Sister Elizabeth, waves their black habits at us. What have I told you about not waving back? Sedge glistens along the turnpike. Someone once told me the name of those flowers, a man I wanted nothing to do with. Another asked, why do women need to be girlfriends? We are approaching the swamp. Too many sycamores mean not enough water, so we grow wary of swamp dwellers, sexless in their low-eyed ways. What's with the inaccessibility of leopard frogs, or the way Sister Elizabeth hikes up her skirt, joyful with dirt? Up close, I see the petals are in fact yellow. Still another would not approve of such details, though I loved him. I'd tuck honeysuckle into his wallet. He'd point out stagnant water, that stench of rotting wood and insect death. Devotion's odd jewel, a trail without shade, the aloof August light, joyful with dirt. Sister Elizabeth calls memory a window into new life. I quote, bah humbug, God of old books, knee-jerk God, girlfriend's God. Nor is the mud benevolent. We stand and drown. Hackensack, Passaic, Raritan, Delaware, New Jersey's algae drift and drear clutter our map with riparian veins. Mr. J. Devil, come out, come out. Sister Elizabeth's brandishing her ivory cane. Today the sky glows aquamarine, tomorrow it rains turpentine. Yes, the good smell of the garden state, the cracked snail shells baking on an off-white shore. Is this where the river ends? Holy humidity, can nuns wear shorts? Your dance card, Sister Elizabeth, lists my name beside a big fat X. I won't ask about the overlooked waltz or your swing time propensities, for we are out of time. Downstream, we cannot find his body. Upstream, we cannot find his body. The sum of hours equals. I wear decay as a necklace to spook myself. A twig in your pocket, Sister Elizabeth, or a compass. We are out of time. Better question, oak or south? Sister Elizabeth prays at the bridge. What if? God of steel girders, God of pigeon shit, a feast of light crumbling at our feet. I'd rather not reach the end, only to discover the end is whim, as when that swarm of dark water turned out to be an upsetting of the river floor, some wild foot kicking out the bottom feeders, that clot and that ink blot. Where's your body, Sister Elizabeth? Under the holy folds, the heat that makes nonsense of your dress. The bridge opens up for us. We know we will fail, and the current will unlearn us. My water skin, the ocean's clock. We love loss as we love ourselves, secretly and too much. And this poem is in the voice of the drowned person from this previous poem, and an orison, O-R-I-S-O-N, is also a type of prayer. Orison, nothing but bad weather. Rain feeds the river, but fog obscures all. Blue fog, fog of a too mild winter. Death means I do not feel the difference, this coldness the mind makes. Your mind counts seconds in the propeller's revolutions, those helicopters revolving in the sky. Time roars and does not stop roaring. What is my name? Your ailing. Dark water of not thinking, the knowledge of fog. I don't need a voice or arms or the algae house of my shoes. Once I thought death will be an empty room, but death is crowded. How the river bottom fields debris and the solitary pike navigates what looks like river wheat. Do I feel the rain? The direction of water goes this way. No, that way. I feel my body become the rain, the thunder I confuse for my searchers, your daily prayer for finding me. How to live in an American town. I woke early to find the dog once again sleeping alone in the front room. He dreams what I dream, blue-eyed children, somehow mine, somehow upright as the summer grass, taller than this rain. I have never had a dream come true. No, not true. There was the one about you, the one where a kitchen catches fire and you are the only one who knows not to pour water on the flame. And the fire was like my dream children, and everyone is standing quite tall, our heads brushing against a low cumulus cloud, submitting ourselves to the blind craft of terror. I've been unkind to strangers, unkind to you. I did not thank you about the fire, which to this day still scorches. This is true. I opened the door and bargained with the dog. If you run, I'll relinquish the dream to you. You love the field, the blue eyes. What do I love? I love the dog. I love an empty room. I want to love less than I know. I'd like to never know the dog dying, that he will die, that I don't know he's dead now, because I'm listening to the rain. So run with him, please. Take the kitchen fire. Run, heart, run. You'll hear me crying at the threshold. Run as far as Duluth, Helena, Lone Pine, California. Run farther to a town like this one, but without all the lousy rain. I hear grief burns faster there. Robert Frost calls poetry a momentary stay against confusion, And last spring, I was looking for momentary stays against confusion, so I decided to literally turn that into an assignment for myself, and I wrote these short lyric bursts. They're trying to make sense of something, something that I didn't even know how to, I can't even describe it now, it's just confusion. And I call them epistemes, and some of them, I of course revised them, like, they weren't just bursts, but they're all called epistemes, which are a system of thought. And I think I read a couple of them, maybe not in a row. And this one, I just have them numbered, episteme 12. Two radish leaves tell me you are gone. I sat in the night field to better articulate the stars. I pretended to hate you. Now rain reading me well. Pine quills on the western path to you, the hemlock clarity of the grove, the first radishes of the season, distant traffic outpacing my thoughts. I have one thought, noise wrecked, a Socratic question, why Jack in the pulpit and the tyranny of ailanthus trees? I bite the bitter root of loving you. I unstitch rain from wax flowers, monk's hoods. If loving were the august truth, white rage, hard flesh, the skylark is more hardy than the nightingale. These poems all seem to be about rain, which is funny because when Marcia was driving me over here, or driving me from the airport to the hotel yesterday, she was telling me about the drought, and I thought, oh, I can't read poems about rain in a drought town. When I looked out the window, I have to say I was a little bit pleased before coming here. So I added a couple rain poems. Just a few more poems. But in keeping with poems as sort of philosophies, it's something we talked about in workshop today, how poems are songs, but they're also often begin an inquiry into the nature of being, the nature of life and who we are, how to understand who we are. So I thought I would write some faux philosophy poems. And there's a group of three. It's called Small Philosophies. And each section has a little title. Small Philosophies. Phenomenology. Now the fever root, the marshweed, the marigold. Now the twin hours of peony and delphinium. Forge the clover-fraught field, the field-fraught clover. Permit the forest armature, neither elm brigade nor garden lust. You are a twilight and a twilight bird. Isn't that a sparrow forlorn in the greenest branches? Why forlorn? Because the clouds have gone brute. You are a quality and a thing silenced by pine shrunk, stern willow. Now run and hide in the fern. Logic. The spectacular math of the walker is specular. Sidestep the poison oak, thus the walker measures aslant. He values the verity of decency and will not disturb New Hampshire's granite ascent. And there is a calculus to crossing the field by which the walker demonstrates an unknown number of wilting flowers. Who can grasp a lily of the valley of the field? Every tall grass feigns wheat, and yet, rash and burn. When will the walker play lover? When will his walk be well companioned and amorous? The walker's rule is recognition, not sex. Again, he seeks the fire pond of his youth. Epistemology. Here is an ice house that no longer houses ice. Here is an alfalfa meadow in need of mowing. Here is the barn where a sauced and saucy welder has left behind his anvil. It was never his barn. Here is a clearing in the woods that didn't exist until December's ice storm. It was once a grove of maiden ferns and hardwood trees. A kind man cleared the roots and trunks, then kindly retreated. I have stood in this clearing and cannot decide if I miss the trees or if I love newborn clarity. How can I love a damaged place? But I love rooms and cities I'll never return to, and once I loved a man for how he damaged me. Here is the footbridge, unbridged by that storm. Here is the fire pond the walker could not find. He did not know my route. Here is the water. Where is the fire? And the title of this poem, it comes from Romeo and Juliet, when Romeo and Juliet are trying to interpret what kind of bird is singing out the window. Some say the lark makes sweet division. I have a daughter, I say. Here is my daughter, I say, and here is the poem, where you and I intend a cool hour in the future. I break your heart. That is how a poem should begin. And then you break my heart, because that is how a poem should end. Sapsucker, scarlet tanager, Carolina wren. We are awake in the bird ruckus, dawn riot that frees the sun to heat. You must believe me when I tell you my daughter is made of salt and noise and dew. Every poem is Eden, and every poet is Adam, and isn't that the silver gate unlatched by a hermit soldier wielding a sword of flame? Open the windows, magnolias and their rotting blooms. Latch that gate, keep out the drought, the ruin post-solstice, our season's late blaze. I am counting, counting, and this is what I learned about love and how to have a daughter. The world is starting over in this poem. You have a lovely daughter, you say, because the trees are kind to you this morning, and you are learning from the trees. Catalpa, elm, let's name her together. I am thinking of a number between 1 and 10. The morning wants a child, but here is our sweat, and what is a poem? We are counting, counting. A poem is a measure of time. I want to hear a story only you know. How far did you swim to the pelicans loitering on the dock? And how old were you when the reach of your arms matched a pelican's wingspan? My daughter has no name because she is a word in this poem, and you are a man like an alphabet, fundamentally wise. But that is why you will not choose a number between 1 and 10. When I ask for the time, when I wonder about the weather, you say fine and fine. I agree. I have a lovely daughter. So I'm going to end this reading with two final poems that are a little bit different, but I wanted to end with them because we are at a women's writers conference, which feels really special to me. And these were both poems that I had given as gifts to women friends of mine. And I don't know if they're written with love, but they were given with love. So, and this first one is about, all I need to tell you is it's about watching YouTube, so which I did this morning. Conversation with Slugs and Sarah. Up late watching slug porn, you confess you had a boyfriend who could spin you like that. Slug grace and slug ballet, we don't touch the topic of slime. And those eyes dangling from tentacle tips must be a kind of love or lust, sighting farther and nearer all at once. But are those eyes? Slug sublimity suggests love's a drag, touch that lingers and leaves a wet trail of memory and... What did we do before YouTube? Boob tube. Boobs, we have none. Slugs, of course, don't care. Can't tell girl from boy, being, you know, hermaphrodites, and only want flesh to fly. Forget their infamous languor. Here's litheness in loving, buoyant miracles of want. One slug spiraling on the axis of another, like a globe slapped by an insolent hand. Neither old nor young, we're familiar with sluggishness, too tired to explain why nothing makes us spin like that, a swirl, a pirouette, a gyre. It's either fucking or marriage, I say, saying more than I mean. Why can't lust be love and love be lust, you're always asking. Even now, as the slugs begin their sluggish withdrawal, each complete in love and lust, each mother and father to what they've made together, each alone, content and free. And thank you so much for listening. I think I'm losing my voice. Okay. Good night, ladies. The hens won't do what we want them to. They bristle, squat, grow petulant under my reaching hand. But it's time to go home. The sun stretched to a streak of rose flush along the fir tops. The days turn lilac cold. Not yet night, though I feel the darkening in my arms, frail tremor, the birds pin-boned, all fluff. It's too early, or I'm too clumsy, to corral the rest of the cluster from under the coop. I track their hop and dawdle, lopsided as drunks and twice as stubborn. I reason with corn feed and terror, point out unseen fisher cats skulking beyond the pen. One hen circles hen-pecked trenches, burrowed seats of safety. Another wing flaps haplessly, mad at her grounding. They're scared of me, but I'm scared of what I can't see. Maybe fisher cats, maybe the last suck of breath that unmakes me, the shadows I pretend to love. Who wants the door to close, to be wrangled by strangers, then cooped up? We're all chicken. Yes, it's written in the twilight sky, the poem of our good night. I carry a warm hen in my hands, brown feathers, softly unfeathering, and her nervous coo. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I think I was, as listening to Jennifer's work, I think we have some overarching themes, loss, girlfriends, and drowning, which seems to appear quite a bit. I'm going to talk about Orange Crush and tell you sort of where the book arose from. There are two main figures in the book. The first is the orange girl, and the second is the dead girl. The orange girl is a historical figure who, during Restoration England, was someone who would sell citrus in the theater, usually 12 to 16, to generate enough income to stay alive. But throughout history, it became sort of a euphemism for selling themselves, which became another way to keep themselves alive when they had no money. So there is that figure, and then there's the more stereotypical figure of the dead girl, which is something that infiltrates our culture. And for me, it's less about the cliche, but in the sense that as women, and some men as well, I think we carry the dead girl in our psyches. And what I mean by that is for myself and most of my friends, at one point in our lives, we've either been wished dead, someone has attempted to kill us by preying on us, or in some ways, we've existed by knowing young women who have died. So the book is dedicated to quite a few people. One is my mom, who spent many years in a physically abusive relationship, in which she was often threatened with death. Another is my best friend who was raped twice, one at gunpoint, one at knife point. And another is a young woman whom I never knew who lived on the same block as me in Colorado, Boulder, and who was beaten to death with a baseball bat right the night before Christmas. And so the book is permeated with darkness, but in that, I guess I would say I'm trying to exhume women's voices and give us voice. And I would say that I am not just a witness in this book. I also have the experience, since this is the anniversary of September 11th, I'll tell you a brief anecdote and then open with that poem. On September 11th, 2001, I was diagnosed with a very rare form of cancer during the bombing of the trade centers. I had the cancer that Farrah Fawcett recently died from. And so I had to come to terms with being told that I may die and sort of the insignificance of that in the face of a larger suffering. So this first poem that I'm going to read is a response to a critic. I usually, it doesn't upset me what critics say, but this one, it really upset me because she said I had no duende. And for those of you who don't know the word, I'm sure most of you do, but it's a complicated term, but essentially death or depth of experience. And so the title is from Lorca, who coined the concept, and it's a title from one of his poems, Where Does Your Body Rest? And it's for the critic who said I liked duende as I was undergoing chemo and radiation. The weather signed the guest book and left us bereft, told we'd never be loved, we nightmared together. Noise webbed its way through as we imagined slinging peach pits into the river, dreaming of green light and luck and chainsaws, the tender windmills of hands. Maria, we speak with black slats and spun sugar as we swerve to the grit, grinding our eyes into tomorrow's shadow cast. We play the game of blankness. Are we to be late carry-on in a late century? A post-it note on a disintegrating object. A colossal flame that bends to its own heat. A clean cotton nightgown with yellow bows that signals disease for lease. Maria, you say we have no blackness. We're silk stockings so transparently nude. Our skin strung between fever tree and error. Your guess is gilded frame, say portrait or perishable, and still you wouldn't know insomnia from enamored. You say we have no via doloroso, but cup your ear, Maria, to the gear slippage in our voices, stranded in this Arctic dark. And where are you now, Maria? Why won't you answer our knock? And then I'm going to move to the Orange Girl series, and this is the prelude poem, and it's called Psalm, because if you want to talk about women in binds, you have to start with the Bible. Fever-damaged girls light up in a row, spells and vixens and dead calico kittens. The convent said fire, the fire said kindness. Kindness took a victim. Bone bonnets for the little girls sleeping and blue beds for their snapped necks. A kiss is a bite is a bit, slit in the clouds above a slit throat. A black coat and a black glove went missing. One girl was fallen in cold golden light, girl killed by frost, a man's hand on her starched white collar. Undone and saturated with woodburn, while snow descended like laudanum. Doctor, come quick, the little girls are sick, their voices muffled by smoke and wool, hands and psalms. Hurry, hurry, it's the eclipse. The girls aren't breathing and the chapel is leaking. Doctor, come quick, someone's a heretic, someone's a witch. And this is the Orange Girl Suite, and I'm not going to read all of them. There are quite a few, and I'm going to skip around. But all of the titles come from the Oxford English Dictionary, and this is the first title. They're very long, but they give sort of a narrative to a very fractured subject narrative. Young women carrying baskets of oranges used to stand near the stage in London theaters and sell oranges at 6 pence apiece and themselves for little more. Between dresses we came, between naked and nothing we slipped into the delirious coils of perfected ears, pear dust on our skin, sarsaparilla sounding our fizzied song in sailor mouths. We were translated by church women who placed umlauts over our words. When we recovered, we were sold in beautiful clothes, sent sailing into the gulf where the moon pitched its lemon lateness over the celluloid slickness of sea. We were movie stars who never entered the frame. We were green and gone, lisping O-words in the air, ode, odalisk, obituary. 2, the rind of the orange is hot and the meat within it is cold. There are 2 ways to peel an orange, in fragments or in one coiling brightness. Let us rewind and revel in the orange aid of sun-decked eyes. Turn me spinning in a carousel sweet dress, earmarked by radio teeth, red leaf breath. Your arm is on fire as we ride in a dark car to the carnival. The constant clink of seatbelt to belt buckle. The sky's cotton candy melting in a girl's cold mouth. 4. The soft night wind went laden to death with the flowering orange scent. Tongues harvest petals, larvae. The back of the throat is petticoat pink. The girl in the dirty dress is dead. I wish I were a fish lit by phosphorescence. I wish I were in Spain. I wish I were bluegilled and beautiful. A man folds the girl up in newspapers, her wet hair, a string of taffy, a rope, something unraveling inside the man's eye. When he killed her, he said, listen. When he killed her, he said, your soul, orange girl. He said, windowsill. He said, stone. While alive, she replied, oil slick, door jam, something passing through my right eye. Black cars and carousels, pretty maids all in a row. 7. At the end of the table, a marmalade gelatin mermaid bathed in a brass basin of orange flower water. No one can be reached in this city of correct syntax, where water deposits its marginalia. This city of aqueducts and evening gowns sweeping the cobblestones, a girl dragged along the waterfront, dropped in a dumpster, wearing a yellow shawl and pearl earrings. Her hair, once smelling of pears and held by tortoise shell, now covered in banana spiders, greasy eggshells. This city closes its windows to the odor and forgets that a girl went missing, forgets any girl who got herself strangled. The canal said body, the body said murder. Murder said, get me a witness while I wait for a soft-armed girl carrying fruit and soup to her sick mother. This city is thick with cold cases and ripped pantyhose, ligature marks, and headlines blaming women for wearing short skirts after dark. And as you move through these, they start out as a record, and then they redress these wrongs. And so this is a redress poem that tries to give salutation to the dead. And I will say one of the quotes that opens the chapter is the fabulous Kathy Acker, who says, all of us girls have been dead for so long, but we're not going to be dead anymore. And this is called Chiaroscuro. And I'm going to read this, and then I'm going to close with a poem that reminds me of Kentucky. Chiaroscuro. Word light, sea light, teeth light, the darkness still visits us with bad names in bad places, places we escaped when people said hoodlum and sweater girl. Girl, don't regret the way the light tears your dark hair into highlights, into lumen lines. Lines are a way to divide the seamen from the landmen, saddles from horses. Horses gather at the shore, their thickness silhouetted by moon's loose light and reflection. Reflected in the sea is the reversal of yourself, a smudge in the vastness. Vast is a word the sea owns. Beneath it, your shadow shines. And I'm going to switch to my first book, which is much more narrative, and I'll talk about that tomorrow. Jennifer and Patricia and I are on a panel talking about narrative and non-narrative poetry. But this is actually, I'm from the South, so I'm from Louisiana, and we are all the stereotypes of alcoholics, and since I've gotten here, everyone loves to talk about bourbon. Bourbon and horses and bluegrass, so it reminds me a lot of being in the South, which I miss. So thank you, Lexington, for having me, and thanks to all of you for being here. And so this is called Desire Takes a Road Trip to New Orleans. Desire changes her name to Desiree so people will stop asking if she's an abstraction or a reality. She buys a blue Nova, spins towards New Orleans via Texarkana, where she saunters into Ricky Dell's Roadhouse for a Gibson chilled with onions that she pops into her mouth before leaning over the bar to lick the bartender. 8 days later, he still shakes with the wisteria scent of her hair and the sweet acid of onions hovering over his upper lip where his mustache singed away. All the matches in the bar are black by the time Desiree shifts into second with the ease of a boy switching his affections from his mother to his first girlfriend that he finger-fucked in his dad's silver Impala beneath a moon hung in the sky like a wind chime, the stars sounding out a song that only those with an ocean beneath their ribs can hear. At Trenton Episcopal, Desiree decides to use the bathroom. The choir boys are singing hallelujah when she jaunts in like a lucky horseshoe. Suddenly, their platelets ring her name while God's golden mallet hammers away at their malleable, sin-soaked hearts. When Desiree arrives on the esplanades, all the boys on the bayou gather to sing. With crooked hearts and crooked feet, we flee down a crooked road as we pray, oh, Desiree. She slits her skirt up her Creole thigh, strides like she's late for a date with Dante Alighieri. She's got nowhere to go, but she likes the leg's elongation, the stretch and flex of muscle, the way the calf bunches up like a ball, that she could spiderweb the windows of those indifferent to her siren serenade. And she knows if she practices her fastball, she'll shatter the glass ceiling of heaven and shards will scatter the earth in a simulacrum of lust as the flushed lips of sordid saints say, oh, Desiree, Desiree, only to you we pray. Thank you. Julie had asked if Jennifer and I would come up and maybe spend 10 minutes for Q&A if any of you have questions. Yes.
With the new book, how did you decide to focus on this idea of the orange girl? Is it something you came across in reading or other research? And how did it evolve?
I was reading a book of paramours, famous paramours through history, which, you know, often get slotted as sex queens, essentially, but in fact they had immense power. And I'm going to space the name, but it's something with paramour in the title, but it's by Princess Michael of Kent, and she's the one that introduced me. Nell Gwynn is the most famous Orange Girl. And as I was reading this, I was doing a collaborative exercise with my best friend, who's a poet. We were sending one another 20 lines a day. And at that time, I received a spam email, which was "Your soul, Orange Girl." And so I started thinking about how history is never linear, that we're always caught in this bind, and it's how we unravel that bind and get out of it. And so those were the initiating impulses of the book.
Thank you for that question. It is an important issue, and I think I love pronouns, and I love Dickinson, and someone I was thinking about too is Plath, because I was teaching Plath last year, and I asked a colleague to observe me, and who I really respected and wanted his teaching advice, and we were talking about the hymns and the he's throughout Ariel, and at one point the class was talking about he as a historical he, the history that is he, every he. And my colleague interjected and said, "Oh no, it's Ted Hughes. No, it's obviously Ted Hughes." But I think especially for women writers, he's and you's are really interesting to use because of the suggestive variability, in that we, you know, it's too easy to assume that he is, you know, someone's husband or someone's partner, or that he is God. I guess to also go in a roundabout way, I like how pronouns open up a poem. The one thing I understood about algebra was the idea of the variable, that the variable would change according to the equation, that x could be whatever was its context. And I feel the same way about pronouns too. Like I like the suggestiveness of Dickinson's pronoun because of that. Because, I mean, one of the things that happens in Dickens scholarship is everyone wants to figure out whether or not she was a virgin, whether or not the you was God, or was it some, you know, neighbor who deflowered her. And I mean, on the one hand, like I find that very suspect a scholarship, but I understand that sort of curiosity, and I do like to play with that curiosity in my own pronoun use. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. But again, we have characters in the poem that aren't, I guess, the identities aren't specifically named. So I guess this is just a broad question about naming in poems. And of course, your work with the Orange Girls, it names a specific history, and there are certain things that are given to us when we enter into a poem. So I don't even know if that was a question, but yeah, if you could just speak about how you decide on naming.
Well, for that particular poem, I wanted there to be a name. I wanted to have a character of Sister Elizabeth. And you know, I wanted there to be the sort of religious overlay of a sister, but I also wanted to invoke sisterhood. In Elizabeth, too, is just the name of the town I grew up in New Jersey. And when I moved back to Jersey City, I kept thinking, I should go back to, it was only about, you know, 3 miles from where I grew up, and I kept thinking about going back there. So there was that sense of a pilgrimage that I never actually completed.
For me, there's something, you know, poetry for me is salutation and homage. So I use a lot of people's names. In my fourth book coming out, that I talked to my class about today, I have a poem called Dear Rachel Corey, who was a young woman killed in the Gaza Strip. As far as the critic, I don't tell you what magazine, and I don't give her last name, but I actually kept her name because I wanted the play on the Mother Mary and Ave Maria about this poem about death and salvation. So she just serendipitously had a great name to use, and I love the lyricism. So that was more because I like the texture of her name that I needed to name her because I didn't need to name her. But in other cases, for me, it is significant to name people, especially when they're dedicatory poems.
I'll also add that in my first book, I don't use names at all. And partly it's a gesture toward the archetypal. But on the other hand, I've always thought of it as an invitation that it could be about anyone. And when I dedicated the book to my family, instead of saying to my family, I listed their names out, because to me those were the only names that mattered when I was putting that together, even though those weren't names that had anything really to do with what I was writing about, other than a sort of archetypal family. But
it's 15 after, and Julie, I don't know where she is, but she asked us to be done at 15 after. So I just want to thank all of you for coming, and hopefully I will be seeing some of you again.
I'll second that. Thanks. Thanks, Mo.
This has been a presentation of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky. Copyright 2010, all rights reserved.